the close of Vivaldi's C major violin concerto here on BBC Radio 3, where it's time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for tonight's prom, presented by Katie Derham.
Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall and to a programme that focuses on the dark side of life. It's Death who turns out to have some of the best tunes tonight as the BBC Symphony Orchestra takes to the stage with conductor Thomas Adès. In the second half of the prom, he's going to be conducting the world premiere of his latest major work, a song cycle for two voices and orchestra called Totentanz, Dance of Death, inspired by a 15th century wall hanging which must have frightened the living daylights out of churchgoers of St. Mary's in Lübeck in Germany. Mezzo-soprano Christiane Stortein and baritone Simon Keenly's side will be the soloists, and many critics are saying that this could be the significant premiere of this year's prom season, so do stay tuned for that. The concert begins, though, with Benjamin Britten's great orchestral masterpiece, the Sinfonia de Requiem, and then Paul Watkins is the soloist in Witold Lutosławski's Cello Concerto, written under communist oppression in Poland in the late 1960s. Let's hear from tonight's conductor, Thomas Adès himself.
The three pieces in the programme seem to me to belong to the same universe, really. And the Britten is about war, of course, but there's a slight feeling of Last Judgment about it as well. It's that kind of apocalyptic time just as the war was getting going, and it felt like the end of the world. My piece obviously deals with the ultimate foe. The Lutosławski has that atmosphere too, very much.
So this prom begins, as I mentioned, with Britten's Sinfonia de Requiem, written in 1940, when the composer, a committed pacifist, had moved to the USA. It became a musical memorial to his parents, though in fact it was commissioned by the Japanese government to mark the 2,600th anniversary of the Mikado dynasty. This, I should add, was before Pearl Harbor. Britten produced a piece in three continuous movements. The titles of the movements are taken from the Requiem Mass, so we have the Lacrimosa, which is a slow marching lament, then the Dies Irae, a mechanistic sort of dance of death, more of that later, and then the Requiem Aeternam, an anguished resolution to the piece. Britten himself did say that his Sinfonia de Requiem was pretty much as anti-war as possible. He also said that it was, in a letter, he said it was so personal and intimate, a piece that's rather like those awful dreams where one parades about the place naked. It's rather embarrassing, he said. Well, the applause you can hear is for the leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Stephen Bryant, who is taking his seat at the front desk now. And any minute now, we should hear the approach. Here he comes. Of tonight's conductor, Thomas Adès. Coming onto the stage here at the Royal Albert Hall to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in the first piece of tonight's prom, Benjamin Britten's Sinfonia de Requiem.
Thank you. Thank you.
Benjamin Britten's Sinfonia da Requiem, the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Thomas Eddowes here at the Royal Albert Hall in tonight's prom. Of course, BBC Radio 3 is celebrating the centenary of Benjamin Britten's birth this year. He's one of the featured composers at the proms. We've already heard his 4C interludes on the first night. Wonderful performance, also by the BBC Symphony Orchestra. It really is a wonderful personal, intensely personal piece, isn't it, that Sinfonia da Requiem? And as I was reading in tonight's programme notes, and mentioned earlier that this was actually commissioned by the Japanese government, but it was actually rejected by the Japanese government. It had been part of a sort of a secret competition, but they said it was a musical and cultural insult. They said it was just too miserable, too Catholic, they said. Finally, when it was premiered in 1941 at Carnegie Hall by the New York Phil under John Barbarolli, all mention of the original commission had disappeared. No huge surprise, bearing in mind that date there. And there was just the dedication in memory of my parents. So, moving on from Britten now, and we are listening to tonight's BBC Prom live from the Royal Albert Hall here on BBC Radio 3. The home of the proms, the only place you can hear all the concerts live during the season. So do stay tuned throughout July and August through to September the 7th. Well, Benjamin Britten is not the only centenary we're celebrating at this year's proms. Witold Lutosławski is also in the spotlight, a composer who lived through one of the most turbulent centuries in Poland's history, but who always maintained that art and politics did not mix. The great cellist Mieczysław Rostropowicz, who's the dedicatee of Lutosławski's cello concerto, which we will hear next, disagreed with him over that. Well, our soloist tonight to perform the Lutosławski cello concerto is Paul Watkins, who's very well known to proms audiences.
For the first 5 minutes of the concerto, I'm completely on my own, and I get to start by playing between 50 and 20 open Ds at the rate of one per second, and Lutosławski asks me to play those indifferently, which is the most incredible marking. I've never seen that anywhere else, actually. It's a kind of muted version of what happens later on in the concerto, this incredible conflict between the cello and the orchestra, and between lightness and great sort of darkness, and possibly the indifference of the Soviet system, although Lutosławski really guarded very much against putting that kind of programme on his music. But I think in private he did admit now and again that the whole concerto may have something of the struggle of the individual against the state. You could sort of roughly divide the concerto up into four sections. Once I've done my opening thing, which has an awful lot of quarter tones in it as well, that's the other remarkable thing about this concerto, is that he uses quarter tones in scales, kind of squished up chromatic scales, really, literally frolicking up and down the fingerboard, and then you come back to this indifferent D, and then the trumpets come in and cut you off. It's a real shut up. They come in, and then there are three sections after that where I'm in dialogue with the woodwinds and with the percussion and with the strings, and this leads to what, to all intents and purposes, is a slow movement, incredible sort of cantilena, which has very disturbing, almost horror movie-like strings, then the most enormous apocalyptic tutti, then the quarter tones really come back with a vengeance, and then it's full-on war between me and the orchestra. I think I win in the end.
Paul Watkins speaking there about his experience of playing the Lutosławski Cello Concerto, which we are about to hear performed by him with the BBC Symphony Orchestra. You know, Lutosławski himself said that he would only go so far as to suggest that the relationship in the concerto between cello and orchestra was one of conflict. So make up your own minds as you listen to it now, because here onto the stage now comes Paul Watkins to perform Lutosławski's cello concerto with the BBC Symphony Orchestra. And with him, also taking a bow, is the conductor tonight, Thomas Eddowes.
Thank you. Thank you.
Dramatic stuff there. Ludoslavsky's Cello Concerto, Paul Watkins doing battle with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Thomas Adès. Did he win? Well, I wonder what you thought. I think he probably did. Masterful playing there from Paul Watkins. You know, he used to be the principal cello here at the BBC Symphony Orchestra, so a familiar, much-loved face. He's also a conductor. He went off to be a solo cellist, of course, and performs concertos all over the world. He's also currently music director of the English Chamber Orchestra. But perhaps most excitingly, just earlier this year, he was announced as the new cellist in the Emerson Quartet, receiving another cheer from the crowd here at the Royal Albert Hall. Yes, the Emerson Quartet, perhaps the best quartet in the world, some say. They haven't had a change in their lineup for 34 years. They could have had anyone. They chose Paul Watkins when their cellist left. So he's moved to New York to play with them. As I say, great news for them and for him. But wonderful response to that Ludoslavsky Cello Concerto here in the Royal Albert Hall. Polish music is one of the themes of this year's prom season. We heard some Ludoslavsky on the first night. We heard his variations on a theme of Paganini. And you'll be able to hear the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, the BBC Chorus of Wales, and the BBC Symphony Chorus is Szymanowski's third symphony, the Song of the Night, tomorrow night, live here on Radio 3, home of the proms. Now, Paul Watkins has come back to the stage for a second time, which makes me think we might get an encore.
Ludoslavsky. Thank you.
Ludoslavski indeed from Paul Watkins. That was his Zacher variation for solo cello, written in 1975, one of the many tributes paid to Paul Zacher, the founder and conductor of the Basel Chamber Orchestra and Choir, great commissioner of new works on the occasion of his 70th birthday in 1976. Well, the applause and the appreciation for Paul Watkins continues, as you can hear, here in the Royal Albert Hall, and from the BBC Symphony Orchestra, his old colleagues as well. He's today's featured Proms artist, you'll be interested to hear, here on BBC Radio 3. When we asked for three of his top musical recommendations for you to listen to, he said Bach Gobbo Variations, no surprise for cellos, Britten War Requiem, and Mozart's Divertimento in E-flat for string trio. So there you go, there's some hints and recommendations from Paul Watkins, and what better man to take some recommendations from. As you can hear, the applause has come to an end. It's time for the interval here at the Royal Albert Hall at the Proms tonight. And in keeping with the Polish theme of this year's Proms, here is Rana Mitter.
In Britain, we have an awful lot to thank Poland for. Joseph Conrad, fighter pilots during the Battle of Britain. Pickled cucumber. Okay, maybe not the pickled cucumber. But in the last couple of decades, Poland has moved from the edge of our consciousness to the centre of our lives. Poles are now the largest minority group living in the UK, and they're visible everywhere in our labour force. Polish is the third most spoken language on these islands, after English and Welsh. But the one place where Poles lack visibility in our national life is in the literary world. The influx of immigration from Asia and Africa led to the redefinition of British writing as global writing. But what are Poles in Britain reading and writing? And what should we be reading to find out more? Well, to explore this question, I have two writers who are, as you might say, at opposite poles. Eva Hoffman is originally from Krakow, but has worked around the world and won acclaim for her memoir, Lost in Translation. A.M. Bacalar is the first Polish woman writer to publish a novel in English since the accession of Poland to the EU in 2004. And that's her much acclaimed novel, Madame Mephisto. Would you please welcome them both here tonight? Asia, you've said in the past that Poles are Britain's invisible minority, and that might even be true of someone who the British think of as one of their great writers, and that, of course, is Joseph Conrad. It seems to me that the Polish element of his personality has been claimed and overwritten, in a sense, by his Britishness. British, yes. Do you think Poland needs to reclaim him?
I remember when I was studying English literature at the university back in Poland, in Wrocław, and we always, when we were taught about Joseph Conrad, we always thought about him as a British writer, not a Polish writer. Of course, we knew his real name, which was Korzeniowski, because he changed it later, because he was just like a mouthful. But to me, he was always a British writer. Maybe because he never really wrote about Polish people or Poland and Polish identity. Maybe that's why. And I think that's the reason.
I wonder, though, if, Eva, there's another reason for that loss, and this is one where I have to point the finger a little bit, perhaps, at our own tendencies in Britain not to engage with other languages. I mean, very few British people now or in the past have ever learnt any Polish, fewer even than learn French or Spanish. And is there a sense in which we as a culture have willfully closed an important cultural door?
Well, I think that, you know, you have closed the door, but not willfully. I mean, in other words, you know, Polish is a very difficult language. So entering, you know, Polishness and Polish culture via the language is hard, is difficult. There are other ways, of course, to enter the culture and to understand the culture, but yes.
What do you mean by that, Eva? I mean, I've heard that, not least from many Polish people, that Polish is very difficult. Mm. But, you know, it's an Indo-European language, it's got conjugations, declensions, a lot of people used to learn Latin in this country. Mm. What's so special about Polish? Are you trying to keep it away from us?
Yes, it's a conspiracy, actually. Yes, well, I mean, Polish is considered by linguists to be one of the most difficult languages to learn. I cannot tell you exactly why, but there are cases, there are declensions. What?
It's one of the top five most difficult languages in the world.
Exactly. Yeah. It has declensions, cases, tenses, irregularities, many irregularities. It just, you know, isn't easy. It's not impossible, of course, and there are now, you know, people who come to Poland from other places and who actually do learn and master the language. So it's not impossible.
And the pronunciation is really difficult as well. There are tongue twisters, which I could say one of them if you'd like to hear it.
Give us a very quick burst of the Polish tongue twister.
This one is about a beetle that buzzes in the grass. Chrząszcz brzmi w trzcinie w szczebrzeszynie.
Okay, I've now decided I will stick to Chinese, which is a much easier language, which I have been studying for some years, and stay away from Polish. But there is a change in the air, isn't there, Asia? Because
yes.
More Polish literature is now being put into English, not least by small presses. I think you're an editor for one of those. Mm. And I'm wondering, a few years ago, decades ago, for the Indian, the South Asian diaspora, there was a sense of a push from within the community that helped to create a new, more visible literature. Is that happening with Pole Lit as well?
I don't think that there is a push from within the Polish community here in Britain to write. If people choose to write, Poles living here in the UK, they usually write in Polish. I remember going to Edinburgh and I met a group of writers, Polish writers, and they write in Polish with Scottish slang words. Which makes it more difficult if they want to get published in Poland because no one will understand it. So it's a kind of contained literature to Scotland because I couldn't understand it either because I don't speak any Scottish slang or whatever.
So who is that literature for, the community of Poles who live in Scotland?
I think they write for themselves, they write to each other in a way. But the thing is that there is a big problem with the language, like with the English. If you want to write, of course, if you write in Polish, then you hope that you'll be able to, you know, publish your book in translation. But choosing to write in English as a Pole is difficult because not every Pole speaks fluently in English and writes. You know, writing is a completely different thing. Like Eva and I, we write in English, which was a decision we made a long time ago. But it is difficult.
But perhaps, you know, two things perhaps should be added. I mean, first of all, the Indian writers had the advantage very often of having been educated in English, in part at least. So there is that. But, you know, usually diasporic literature is a second or third generation phenomenon. So, you know, if the Polish immigration remains here, there probably will be a kind of Polish-British literature, as there is Italian or Jewish literature in the States.
So in other words, we're at the same position now with Polish diaspora literature in Britain that we were with South Asian literature, let's say, in about 1960, something like that.
I would say so, or yes.
I mean, a difficult question in one way, Asia, but it comes from current political debates. Mm. Is there a sense that the literature is not emerging because perhaps the Polish community that exists here now is not here to stay? It's not there to put down roots?
That's one of the reasons, but another reason is that people come here to make money. So, you know, writing is not exactly on their mind.
But few Indians came here initially to write. They also came for economic reasons.
Yeah, you're right. However, you know, the recent generation, they're surrounded by the Polish language and they don't feel the necessity to speak.
I want Eva to come to our first recommendation in terms of Polish literature. And I should just say that you've actually just had two Sunday features, documentaries, broadcast on BBC Radio 3 about the relationship between Poles and Jews in the 20th century. And I have to say that was in my mind, they were marvellous programmes, when I saw that you'd chosen Paweł Hüller's Who Was David Weiser as your first literary choice. Tell us a bit more about this novel.
Yes. This is a novel which describes an encounter between several schoolboys who are on summer vacation and who are a little bit bored, schoolboys who are perhaps 11 or 12 years old, and who meet a very mysterious boy of their age, who is most probably Jewish, although his origins are not completely clear, and whom they initially try to humiliate, but who turns out to have mysterious and really magical powers, and whom they begin to follow like a sort of magus or Svengali, and who specializes in these performances of explosions, which are almost, you know, a form of performance art, and who eventually vanishes in an explosion. David Weiser, the protagonist, is a kind of revenant from the past. And he not only knows about a lot about the city as it is now, but he introduces the other boys to the city's pre-war and wartime past, but particularly its pre-war past when Gdansk, the novel is set in Gdansk, when Gdansk had a large German population and a
Danzig
Jewish population. It was Danzig, yes. So he introduces them to that past as well. But one reason I chose this book is because it is a very early example of a phenomenon which is very evident in recent Polish literature and post-89 literature, and that is a kind of recovery of the past, a recovery of aspects of Polish history which were suppressed or repressed or censored or forgotten during the communist decades. And particularly, there is a kind of leap backwards over the communist decades and even over the war to the interwar period, when Poland was a very multicultural country, and particularly in its borderland region, particularly in its Ukrainian regions and its Western regions. So he often in his novels has characters who belong to vanished groups, Mennonites or Kashubians or others.
And of course, I've met some Lithuanians who still haven't forgiven the Poles for taking Vilnius away from them in the interwar period.
But not to speak of Lwów.
Right. Well, we won't dig up too many old memories. But Asia, is there a sense in which writers who concentrate on really the post-1989 liberal democratic Poland are still concerned with the kind of questions of memory that Eva's talked about? Or is this kind of old news, old hat for that generation of writers?
No, I think writers, especially in Poland, some of them still write about this. They revisit the past, especially the past during the communist period, during the Solidarity Movement. Interestingly, there is quite a few crime novels being published at the moment in Poland that go back to that time, and the setting is basically during the communist times.
Let's take that moment to move on to your first recommendation, Asia, and that is a book by Anya Lipska called Where the Devil Can't Go. And we should say that Lipska herself is British, but she's married to a Pole. Could you just tell us a little bit about this book?
Yes, this is a very interesting, and the reason why I have selected Anya is because this is a book about Polish people in London. And she wrote this book initially, and she self-published the book, because she couldn't find a publisher in the UK. And the book was also published in Germany, but for some reason she couldn't find a publisher here in the UK. Because the publishers here in the UK were not convinced that a book about Polish people could be sellable.
Commercially viable,
basically. But she has become such a huge success selling the book as an e-book. She eventually found the publisher, and the book was released this year as well as a paperback. The book is about Kiszka, who is a fixer he's like a detective for the solving different problems that Polish community has in London. And he one day has a case of a missing girl, and he goes to Polish community to one family to find out what happened to that girl. At the same time, a body of a young woman is being washed ashore the River Thames, but the investigation takes Kiszka to the past of Poland during the Solidarity Movement, which is quite interesting what we just said. So here we have a British writer who goes back to Polish history.
I mean, it's an interesting thing here, as you say, a writer from the majority culture here, as it were, deciding to place herself inside a minority one. Mm-hmm. And obviously you admire the book, you've chosen it, but does it ring entirely true to someone like yourself who sits within that group?
I absolutely loved it. I was reading it curiously because I wanted to find out how she will portray Polish people here in London. And it was really, really accurate, in terms of food, in terms of behavior. And one of the most interesting things about the book is how Anya shows different generations of immigration. So you've got the older generation, which is more surrounded, concentrated around the church, around very strongly within the Polish community. They don't really speak English. They're very traditional. Whereas the younger generation, like Kiszka himself, for example, or the people that he's meeting in his path, the younger people, they're completely different. They go out, they hang out with the British people as well. They don't really have that much in common with the older generation. So it's very interesting how she has portrayed those two levels in a way. Of
and I have to say one sees all sorts of similarities there with the generational change in other diaspora communities as well. But let me turn to you, Eva, for another recommendation. And this is another literary sensation, in this case, Olga Tokarczuk's Primeval and Other Times. Now, this is a